This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehizhu Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I convened this summit because we have reached a level of human suffering without parallel since the founding of the United Nations. We have the wealth, knowledge, and awareness to take better care of one another. But we need action.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking on the final day of the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul. Details coming up.
Also, Greek authorities begin closing the crowded makeshift refugee camp at the Macedonian border. And Boko Haram militants are believed to be holding hundreds of captives in Nigeria's Sambisa Forest.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, there were more migrant rescues on the Mediterranean Sea today. The Italian Coast Guard and other vessels picked up about 2,800 migrants within a 24-hour period as they tried to make their way from Libya to Europe. Many of the migrants are using flimsy rubber dinghies to make the journey. More than 31,000 have reached Italy so far this year, but that number is expected to rise sharply now that the weather is improving. Officials say well over 1 million migrants and refugees from Africa, the Middle East, and Asia have entered Europe since the beginning of last year. Meanwhile, in Greece, authorities have begun evacuating the makeshift migrant and refugee camp at the Macedonian border. Before the evacuation began this morning, there were more than 8,000 people in the camp at Idomeni. Reporter Mariana Karakoulaki is on the outskirts of the town. Authorities have prohibited journalists from entering the camp to watch the evacuation. She told VOA's Joe DiCapua there is a heavy police presence in the town.
Well, there are around 1,400 police officers in Idomeni. Their plan is to evacuate 4,000 today in order to reopen the train line. This is their excuse. The evacuation has been quite calm, but the presence of the force is huge. It's the first time that so many police officers are in the area, and the helicopters are flying all over the area. I was there until 9 o'clock this morning, but I spent the night in the camp, hiding from the police because they were in the civilian clothing and they were going tent to find journalists and volunteers who were going to stay in the camp and told them to get out, basically. And they also detained two journalists, as far as I know.
Now, you were in the camp. Did you get a chance to talk to any of the migrants and refugees about how they feel about this?
They had no information that evacuation was taking place. They started hearing the rumors midday, basically, and some of them started leaving the camp. The majority of those that I spoke to told me that they will follow the police orders. They know that Idomeni is closing down, so they will go to other camps, which is better, to be honest. I mean, Idomeni is not a permanent camp and the living conditions are horrible. But the way they are doing it, I don't think it's right.
Why not?
They could have informed refugees of their rights and the conditions of the other camps. They did the evacuation at the last minute. They announced it very late. We basically found out that it's happening because we had heard some rumors of forces coming to Idomeni. We could see the signs because the controls were stricter than usual, but we were not sure it was going to happen. So if we were not sure, imagine the refugees who had no information.
Now, you had mentioned that they're going to reopen the train tracks from Greece into Macedonia. Of course, migrants and refugees had often blocked those tracks in protest. What will it mean to reopen those tracks?
These tracks are for freight trains, basically trading from Greece throughout Europe. They start from Greece and they end up in Austria, as far as I know. It has an impact on the Greek economy. And the train tracks have been blocked for a couple of months now because it's not only the fact that refugees were protesting, but they were living on this track. There were tents on this track, so the evacuation started from the track.
That's reporter Mariana Karakolaki from the Greek-Macedonian border. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The World Humanitarian Summit ended today in Istanbul, Turkey. It was attended by representatives of 173 countries and 55 heads of government. The aim of the conference was to improve the delivery of humanitarian aid to the 130 million people in need. On the final day of the summit, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed the press. He expressed dismay that few leaders from the industrial nations came to the event, though progress has been made.
It is a bit disappointing that some world leaders could not be here, especially those from the G7 countries, except Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany. They are some of the most generous donors of funding for humanitarian action. But I urge their greater engagement, particularly in the search for a political solution. The pledges are still coming in. So far, more than 400 member states, organizations, and other groups have made some 1,500 commitments. These will kickstart transformative change from the top down and from the ground up. For example, the Education Cannot Wait Fund will help provide quality education to children and youth in crises. A grand bargain will increase the efficiency and effectiveness of investment in emergency response. Global Preparedness Partnership will better prepare 20 of the countries that are most at risk of crisis. And the 1 billion Coalition for Resilience aims to mobilize 1 billion people to build safer and more stable communities worldwide.
Ban Ki-moon appealed to the permanent members of the UN Security Council to take action on issues of war, peace and security for the world's most vulnerable people. He said he looks forward to the participation of world leaders in September at the UN Summit on Refugees and Migrants. He said member states must demonstrate they are one humanity with one responsibility.
A new model for boosting humanitarian responses to food crises has been launched at the World Humanitarian Summit. Three organizations have announced they've joined forces to tackle one of the world's biggest challenges, food insecurity.
The Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the European Union together launched a new network to achieve joint global food security assessments and joint responses to global food crises, including those caused by weather phenomena such as El Niño. It is the Global Network for Food Insecurity, Risk Reduction, and Food Crises Response. Dominique Bergeon is director of FAO's Emergency and Rehabilitation Division and FAO's Strategic Program Leader on Resilience. He explains why this new approach to food insecurity was launched.
Today, the world is witnessing the highest level of human suffering. 125 million people in the world are in need of humanitarian assistance. Over 60 million people are displaced. This is the highest level in recorded history. While the need for humanitarian assistance keep increasing in terms of people affected and in terms of financial requirements, the gap is also widening in terms of the response to these needs. It is clear that while humanitarian assistance has been remarkable in playing its role over the last decades, humanitarian assistance alone cannot solve all these problems. Therefore, we need to have not only the humanitarian community, but also the development community to join forces to put an end to these needs. And this is what the World Humanitarian Summit is all about.
Bergeon says 70% of people in developing countries depend on agriculture for their livelihoods, and they are regularly hit by shocks such as natural disasters, conflict, and diseases.
It's clear that while agriculture is not per se the topic of the World Humanitarian Summit, it will be very much at the center of the discussions, and what will come out will influence the way we are going to support agriculture-based livelihoods.
Bergeon highlights the summit should also promote the important role agriculture plays in bringing peace and stability to countries, which in turn will foster investing in creating resilient agriculture-based livelihoods.
It will be also important at the World Humanitarian Summit for FAO to emphasize the importance of prevention and preparedness. We know that a dollar invested in prevention can lead to many dollars saved when the response time comes. It will also be important for FAO to highlight the importance of social protection, of equipping countries and people with the right social protection so that they can not only absorb the shocks better, but they can adapt to the new conditions and bounce back better.
The goal of the new alliance of the FAO, WFP, and the European Union is not to provide new information regarding food security. Rather, the partnership will focus on gathering existing food security information from different sources and maximizing the information to provide decision makers with consolidated data that they can use universally. Bergeon says this will not only help to align messages on food security, but help bridge the humanitarian development divide that exists today. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Among the many groups that attended the World Humanitarian Summit is Help Age International, an organization lobbying for the rights of older people. Chief Executive Officer Toby Porter is in Istanbul. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the message he wanted to send to summit delegates.
Help Age International has one overarching message at the Humanitarian Summit, which is that it's time to include the world's women and men that are older, and it's time to include them properly in global humanitarian response. This hasn't happened enough. I'm surrounded by individuals and agencies celebrating a lifetime of commitment to humanitarian causes who work with passion and energy and sacrifice to relieve humanitarian suffering, who recognize that there's lots about the humanitarian system that needs to change. And yet, somehow, in amongst all of this commitment and all of this awareness and celebration of needing to help the world's women, help the world's children, which are desperately important, somehow we still have a situation where older people seem to be the only group routinely and systematically excluded from appropriate services in disasters.
So what needs to be done regarding the humanitarian summit, for example? What recommendations of yours would you like to see in their communique?
Well, that's a very good question, John. There are several categories of vulnerable groups that we need to be confident of getting the humanitarian services appropriate for their given situation. And what we felt is that rather than coming up with protocols and charters for every single different group, older people, children, women and girls, people with disabilities, etc., but it would be better to have something called the Inclusion Charter, really just a general commitment to making assistance appropriate for all population groups. We know that there are some groups in humanitarian assistance that we need to take special care. And are we confident and can we tick off these programs that are designed in a way that works for kids, people with disabilities, men and women equally, and for older people? And I think that that's really what we want.
Let me ask you about one of the big issues at the humanitarian summit, and that is the migrant and refugee crisis. Can you tell us about older people in that crisis?
The data we have is that the population in Syria before the war was about 8% 60 or over. We know the population in the camps in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan, is about 4 or 5% older people. And we know that the population of the migrants on the move into Europe and the refugees are about 1 to 2% older people. So the strong hypothesis is actually that the real needs for older people in the Syria crisis aren't people on the move. They're actually people inside Syria itself, which, of course, is the hardest to reach segment.
Toby Porter is Chief Executive Officer for HelpAge International. From the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Security Council has been asked to document crimes against health workers and to refer cases to the International Criminal Court. AP reports the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition has released a report recording the deliberate or indiscriminate killing of health workers and patients and the destruction of clinics in 19 countries. The report focuses on war zones in the Middle East, but also documents attacks in Africa. It says Nigeria's Boko Haram has destroyed 445 health facilities and killed six doctors in northeast Nigeria since 2012. The report also cites more than 200 attacks last year on humanitarian compounds dispensing health care in the Central African Republic, Congo, Mali, Somalia, South Sudan, and Sudan.
Boko Haram militants are believed to be holding hundreds of captives in Nigeria's Sambisa forest, including more than 200 Chibok schoolgirls kidnapped in 2014. The armed forces of Nigeria and Cameroon are trying to free the hostages, but as Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports, the forest is a good place for militants to hide and a dangerous place for soldiers trying to find them.
The Sambisa Forest Reserve in northeastern Nigeria has been a key Boko Haram hideout for years. Colonel Bubakari Bakari is one of Cameroon's senior military officers commanding troops fighting Boko Haram around the forest.
La forêt de Sambisa, c'est une forêt très, très dangereuse. Je pense que c'est le QG de Boko Haram.
He says Sambisa is very dangerous because it is one of Boko Haram's main remaining strongholds. Many Cameroonian soldiers have lost their lives there. Many Cameroonian hostages they are looking for are in the forest. He says troops are doing everything possible to eliminate Boko Haram and take total control of the area. Cameroon says 30 soldiers have been injured and two killed since a fresh offensive on Sambisa was launched in March. But Bakari said his troops have taken part in raids on the forest for more than a year. Part of the challenge is just how vast Sambisa is, covering parts of four Nigerian states. It's been called an ideal place for Boko Haram to hide because it's large, sparsely populated, and has lots of tree cover that hampers aerial surveillance. It also has few roads and a rocky, hilly terrain, making access by land difficult to nearly impossible. The Nigerian military has bombed the forest and succeeded in overrunning several Boko Haram camps. But the presence of kidnapped women and children remains a concern. Bakari says Boko Haram uses the captives as human shields. The forest, he said, is also infested with landmines. But there has been some good news. In the Cameroonian border town of Turu, hundreds of people turned out Sunday to welcome home Habiba Asale. Boko Haram grabbed the 16-year-old girl and several others 2 years ago and took them into Sambisa. She escaped last week during a raid by Nigerian soldiers, but had to leave her baby behind.
On était amenés dans un village musulman.
She says after they were kidnapped, they spent a few weeks in a detention camp in a cave in Sambisa, and then the girls were handed over to Boko Haram fighters as wives. She says they were also given lessons on detonating bombs and told that if they died fighting Allah's cause, they would go to paradise. She says she is very grateful to all the soldiers that saved her life, but that so many girls and women are still in the forest. Cameroonian journalist Fonka Muta accompanied the military into Sambisa this month.
Obviously, beyond what popular opinion thinks that you could just, you know, storm the place and then solve the problem, it's not that easy.
Cameroon's military says it is giving food and medical care to liberated captives, but that it is impossible to know how many more Cameroonian citizens are being held. Families fearing stigma and retribution from Boko Haram don't always report the abductions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Tsuru, Cameroon.
Ethiopia's foreign minister and previous health minister Tedros Adhanom has thrown his hat into the ring as Africa's first and only candidate for the post of Director General of the World Health Organization. The new UN health chief will be appointed during next year's World Health Assembly. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization, which was established as a United Nations specialized agency nearly 70 years ago, has never had a director general from Africa. Tedros Adhanom hopes to break that mold and promises to wage a vigorous campaign to achieve that goal. He does not impugn the work and achievements of previous directors general, but suggests that the view of global health in the past has been seen through the narrow lens of mainly developed countries.
But as you know, Africa and many of the developing countries carry most of the burden, and we have never given a chance to Africa or a developing country to see the global health from that perspective and to see the global health from those who can understand the root cause of the problem that they have.
Tedros rejects the assertion that he should be appointed to head the WHO because it is time for an African to assume this post. He tells VOA he has the diplomatic and work experience needed to operate in both national and international spheres. But he notes by virtue of his being an African, he can present a fresh perspective to global health issues.
I'm stressing that I'm actually competing based on merit and merit. If you bring someone with experience from Africa, can bring you a fresh view. So there is value proposition to it. We're saying we can add value. Let's see it from a different angle. With experience, but from a region where the burden is the highest in terms of health problems.
Africa's sole candidate for director general has an impressive resume. He's an internationally recognized malaria researcher, and prior to being appointed as Ethiopia's foreign affairs minister in 2012, Tedros was minister of health from 2005 to 2012. He also has served as chair of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.